This is NewsHour from the BBC World Service. I'm Tim Franks. Ever since it came into being in the US, the Affordable Care Act, President Obama's signature piece of domestic legislation, his overhaul of health provision, known universally as Obamacare, has been battered by Congress, by Republican governors, by technical glitches, and now, today, by the US Supreme Court. By a margin of 5-4, the justices ruled that private companies have a right, on the grounds of religion, to refuse to pay for insurance cover providing certain types of free contraception to women. I'm going to try to pick apart not just what this might mean for Obamacare, but also the relationship between religious observance and legislation in the US. First, let's go to the BBC's David Willis in Washington. And Davis, to start off with, tell us exactly what the justices ruled.
Well, it was an issue, Tim, which pitched religious freedom, if you like, against women's rights. Two family-owned firms run by devoutly religious people suing the Obama administration over a clause in the Affordable Care Act, that clause compelling them to provide contraceptive coverage as part of the health care package that they're now obliged to provide to their employees. Now, the companies in question don't object to contraception per se. They object to the kind of emergency contraception, such as the intrauterine devices and the so-called morning after pill, which they say constitute a form of abortion. Now, the Supreme Court has ruled that in their favour, that some family-owned firms in the US can limit access to birth control in their employee healthcare plans.
And David, just briefly, how has the White House responded to the ruling?
Well, it's a blow to the Affordable Care Act, but not a seismic one, I would say. The White House said the Supreme Court decision jeopardizes the health of the women employed by these two companies, Tim. It called on Congress to make birth control widely available. The president, the spokesman said, was still reviewing the legal and practical implications of this decision, including, of course, how many people are likely to be affected.
David Willis in Washington, thanks very much for joining us. Let's try and explore a bit further the implications of this ruling. Joining us from Washington, D.C. is Hannah Smith. She's senior counsel with the Beckett Fund, the not-for-profit law firm which fought Hobby Lobby's case. And in South Carolina is Marcy Hamilton, chair in public law at Yeshiva University in New York. Welcome to you both. Hannah Smith, if I can begin with you. Is it right that companies which are run for profit should say that the religious observance of their owners should determine the sort of government-mandated provision for healthcare that its employees are entitled to?
Well, yes, and thank you very much for having me on today. This was a great victory for Hobby Lobby and for people of faith everywhere, because the Supreme Court held today that if you're a family-owned business, you can still practice your religious liberty in your family business. And that's exactly as it should be. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which is the federal law on which the court based its reasoning today, explicitly provides for family corporations to be covered by its provisions. And so, yes, it's entirely appropriate that the Supreme Court held that the Green family and their family business, Hobby Lobby, should have religious freedom rights.
Except the Greens do not personally employ these people. The company does. And, I mean, it's a huge company. It's not some sort of small and medium-sized enterprise. It has 500 stores.
Yes, and the court was very specific today in its holding. It said that this opinion and this decision applies to closely held family businesses.
It's a bit vague, though, isn't it?
So this is not an opinion that's applying to Exxon or IBM or a publicly traded corporation. This opinion is applying to a closely held family business. Okay. And that's what the Hobby Lobby is. And that is also what Conestoga Woods is, which was the companion case in this litigation.
Okay. Well, Marcy Hamilton, what do you make of that? The fact that this is just a narrowly defined exemption for those companies where religious observance matters hugely to the people who own them?
Well, in fact, sometimes it's hard to get to the facts in the religious liberty debates. The fact is 80 to 90% of companies in the United States are closely held. So this is a humongous opinion affecting millions of women. It is definitely a victory for religious believers. It's a victory for them to impose their religious worldview on their employees.
Well, except I suppose a counterargument would be that, you know, if it's all right for non-profit organizations or, for example, universities that are Catholic universities to behave in this way, what's the difference with organizations that are for-profit?
Well, until today, and until the specious arguments were made that RFRA was intended to cover for-profit corporations, it just wasn't even in the picture. For-profit corporations were definitely not intended to be included in RFRA. This is an expansive...
You're talking about the Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
Yes, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. This is an expansive grab for power by corporate authorities in the United States, who are using their religious beliefs to co-opt the marketplace. My main concern here is that we are going to lose our product-based neutral marketplace in goods, and we're going to replace it with a balkanized universe in which we all have to figure out the religious beliefs of a corporation before we're willing to give $1 to that corporation.
Isn't that the point, Anna Smith, that this could open up, whatever one thinks of this particular ruling, this could open up potentially, I mean, not just a case of, you know, how consumers approach this, but also other types of legislation where people could say, well, look, you know, I'm not going to afford that type of privilege or protection to this particular employee because it offends my religious beliefs.
Well, you know, that slippery slope or that Pandora's box, as you've called it, was something that the government argued. It came out in oral argument. Justice Sotomayor raised it in oral argument over and over and over again. And the majority opinion was very specific in saying that we are not opening up a Pandora's box here. This opinion does not apply if somebody wants to discriminate based on race or if they want an exemption because they don't believe in vaccinations. The opinion specifically said this opinion, this decision does not cover those cases.
We are only deciding
this case, and we're not deciding those cases.
Yes, but why not? I mean, if the principle is there, why could it not impinge on those things?
Well, because the legal standard that's being applied is a legal standard that's been around for 50 years, and we haven't seen those kinds of cases arise in the last 50 years, and we're not going to see them as a result of this opinion either. The legal standard that you have to use is a balancing test. It balances the government's interest versus the religious liberty right that's asserted. And, you know, in some of those cases, as the majority opinion noted today, there is a compelling governmental interest in protecting against race discrimination. So we're not going to see an exemption under RFRA for a religious believer who wants to discriminate based on race. It's simply not going to happen.
Okay, well, perhaps not based on race, but Marcy Hamilton, in that case, would you accept that perhaps you've slightly overstated it, saying this has humongous implications?
No, actually, unfortunately, the Beckett Fund has again misrepresented the law. The Supreme Court in this case finally and refreshingly explains RFRA is not the standard that's been in place for 50 years. As they explain, this is a standard that's been in place since about 2000. That would be 14 years. Okay. This is an extreme standard. It is nothing to be unconcerned about. And the notion that the court said that it wasn't deciding the vaccination and the transfusion cases doesn't answer any question. What the court said is they will apply RFRA in those cases in the future.
I said that I was going to ask you to answer briefly. Let's try and widen this out, in fact. Hannah Smith, the implications of this in terms of the companies and how far they might find that this is, you know, legislation that they can explore or a principle that they can explore further. I mean, Marcy Hamilton has said that consumers may have to decide where their dollars are going. Do you think that companies could actually think to themselves, actually, you know, this is a selling point for us, that we're not going to be providing coverage for this type of health insurance for our employees, and actually will make us more attractive to consumers who share our worldview?
Well, you know, I'd rather talk about the actual case that was decided today than these hypotheticals, because if you look at Hobby Lobby, the fact of the matter is they pay almost twice the minimum wage. They offer extremely excellent health insurance for their employees. They cover 16 out of the 20 contraceptives that are mandated by this contraception mandate. They only object to four. They close on Sundays so that their employees can be home with their families. They're incredibly good to their employees. And so this notion that somehow they're a bad employer, that people are going to want to flee from being employees, is just ridiculous. And it really flies in the face of the facts here. And I think, you know, there are family-owned businesses who may have religious objections. For whom this may be a selling point, I don't know. That's not the case before us. But what we have here is a very good company that is very good to its employees and that treats them well, and it just simply wants to be able to conduct their business according to their religious beliefs.
Marcy Hamilton, do you think that this does mark a moment where, I mean, clearly in the US, the separation between religion and legislation has been a vexed issue for a long time. Do you think that it will actually put Obamacare to one side, the passage of legislation more generally, a more complex issue for Congress, because it will have to take into account how those with strongly held religious beliefs might react to it?
Well, you know, in the United States, since about 1990, we've been living with a tyrannical regime in which the lobbyists for extreme religious groups have been demanding extreme rights. And RFRA is one of the things that they've obtained, and partly to discriminate against people in housing and partly to discriminate against gays. This is just part of that. That's the bigger picture here. RFRA is in place in the first instance so that apartment owners can discriminate against people who want to live in their apartments. So what we're dealing with is religious groups exercising their right to lobby. Nobody can object to that. But Congress had the wool pulled over its eyes with RFRA in 1993. It was told it was just the old standard. That was a lie. We now have the Supreme Court exposing that as a lie, and now we have a new era. So we understand now that RFRA is a very dangerous statute that invites discrimination against women and the oppression of those who disagree with other religious believers.
Marcy Hamilton, Hannah Smith, I'm very grateful to both of you. This is NewsHour from the BBC.